Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt and welcome to the latest in our series of Empire Podcast Spoiler Specials. This is the last one of 2014. It is dedicated to Peter Jackson's The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, the fitting conclusion to the saga that is The Lord of the Rings / The Hobbit. Here today to discuss the film and its many twists and turns are three of Empire's biggest J.R. Tolkienites. Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
You have my sword. Dan Jolin.
Well met, my friend.
You have my axe. James Dyer.
I'd meant to look up how to say good morning in the black speech of Mordor, but I got up late, so hello.
Fair enough. Seems good to me. Welcome, guys. Welcome, 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 welcome. Before we start nattering away, as ever, a quick note. If you haven't seen The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies, or indeed if you haven't seen any of the Hobbit films or the Lord of the Rings films, go quickly, avail yourself of them, and then come back here because we will be discussing spoilers in great big detail. Third act and everything. Major deaths and everything. Have you gone? Have you come back?
It is all in the book, though.
It is all in the book. Yeah, the book which was written in
1937.
Yes.
There is a statute of limitations on spoilers. I'm saying it's expired.
Not according to Twitter, there isn't.
Thorin dies, Thorin dies, Thorin dies, Thorin dies, Thorin, Thorin, and Fili and Killy too.
Yeah, this is Kill Fili volume 2. It doesn't suffer from the Return of the King syndrome, does it? It doesn't have too many endings. I think it's quite a fitting end to the
that
saga.
That was a relief, I think. I think I can speak for everyone in the world that it was nice that he went for a very sort of simple, single conclusion to this, which I think fits because it's a slightly less epic, more personal story, and I don't think you need a sort of multi-part sort of epic ending to go with it. That said, he does tie up a few of the loose ends before he goes. So, you know, you have the speech between Thranduil and
Legolas.
And Legolas.
I love that bit.
Which is essentially a trailer for Fellowship of the Ring. Yes, I think we can all agree.
It's you must go find this young ranger. He is known as Strider.
I will not tell you his name.
Marathon.
Yes, sorry. Yeah, so there's a little bit of that, and the foreshadowing there I think is a little bit clunky, but he doesn't spend too much time on that. There's a swift farewell to the dwarves standing in a doorway, and then it's back to the Shire. To be fair, I think one of my favourite parts of the film, which is the moment where, you know, Gandalf comes up to Bilbo and says, you know, magic rings are not to be trifled with, or something like that, and he lies to him for the first time. This hobbit that has been uncorrupted by the dragon sickness, uncorrupted by the gold, by the Arkenstone, and he lies to the wizard. And then you have that moment, that wonderful moment back in the Shire when he's in, you know, in Bag End, in his little bolt hole, and he sort of fingers the ring slightly.
Wow.
If you'll excuse the turn of phrase. And it's that wonderful moment. And I think that's the part where you just think, oh my God, I'm immediately going home to get my extended edition Fellowship box out and watch it now.
Is that your thought? Your first
thought?
That
was absolutely my thought, yeah.
You saw a man fingering a ring, you thought, I need an extended edition?
Yeah.
That's what you thought?
That's
okay,
basically
good.
What it
I think
is.
We I think we've just, if you're playing innuendo bingo at home, I think we've just hit the mother load, so to speak.
Oh. But the multiple ending syndrome is something that Boyens was clearly very concerned about and very anxious to avoid this time, and I think they did. They do have a lot of tying up of ends, but at least they don't have those quite long cuts to black between each one, which led us all to pick up our bags and head for the exit last time.
Am I right in thinking that the shot of Gandalf at the end, when Bilbo's saying goodbye to the dwarfs, and they all appear, and they're all standing there in the doorway, and some of them are desperately hoping to have a line, but they don't get a line or need anything to do, but. And there's a shot of Gandalf smiling, and it's the exact same shot, isn't it? It's obviously a different shot many years later, but it's the exact same framing as his farewell and that shot when they come into Frodo's room at the end of Return of the King, that much parodied.
Yeah, I can't video. Watch that scene anymore after the classic parody. If you haven't seen the parody, look it up. It's special.
Clearly, we will have an interview with Richard Armitage coming up later on, in which he reveals that they did film a funeral for Thorin Oakenshield.
Thought they did.
He's buried with the Arkenstone, as it says in the book. So there's a feeling that there's much more here. There's a 3-hour version knocking around.
Yeah, there is. The extended edition, I think, we'll have, again, as Boyan said, there's going to be a lot in there with the, you know, the fate of everybody else as well. You know, Dane and Bard are sort of, you know, left there. In the book, we know that they become King Under the Mountain and of Dale, respectively, but we don't really see it happen. I think there'll be a bit more of that in the special edition as well as the funeral scenes.
I mean, I might be unpopular in saying this, but I actually thought the film was too short.
First time anyone has ever said that.
Hey, I'm 100% with Dan on this. I think it's because it's not necessarily that I felt, well, I really need another hour and a half. It was more that I really need to see the stuff I didn't see. I want to see more than a single shot of Bjorn, for example. I want to see more eagles. The Dolgaldur thing is perhaps, I think, the film's biggest missed opportunity in that, and I've said this before, it is not only could have been the best sequence in the film, it could have been the best sequence of the year, of the decade. It could have been unbelievable. And yet I felt very much like Jackson was trying to get it out of the way, like he got Smaug out of the way so that he could get on with the battle. And actually, you know, could he have maybe done it slightly differently? Could he have drawn that out and maybe intercut it with the battle to give it a slightly different, almost sort of Return of the Jedi, Phantom Menace-esque, you know?
But then you've got the problem of Gandalf geography.
Eagles, Helen, eagles. They solve all problems.
I'll be honest, there is one thing that occurred to me with the eagles, and that is that they are a hellaciously powerful thing to have on your side.
The tactical nukes of Middle-earth.
They are the tactical nukes of Middle-earth, as well as the buses of Middle-earth. And
they need a union.
Yeah, they do. But, I mean, genuinely, where the hell are they in Lord of the Rings? If they can turn the tide of a battle that big, so decisively, what the heck were they doing
roosting.
In Lord of the Rings? Roosting.
They were roosting. They must have been roosting. Wind. I'm not even sure what roosting is, but I think they were doing it.
I think that just means that they sleep overnight.
Well, there you go. They were having overnight. A big old roost, a massive roost.
That's beginning to sound rude.
Sunday roost.
Peter Jackson's actually been, he has spoken out on this, that he found the eagles very problematic because they are the I win button of this particular franchise. You know, as soon as you bring them in, it's game over. Everything's done.
Yeah.
So he really, really struggled with when to bring them in, and he left it to the last possible moment. And it's such a shame because when they come in, you know, the camera work, this is fantasy Top Gun. I mean, it's unbelievable. The camera's flying around, there's dogfighting with the fell bats, you know, and there's really only, what, a couple of minutes of that? 1 minute of that? Really, really short. I could have watched a feature-length film of just that.
Yeah. I felt they threw away the likes of Bjorn and... who else comes in on the eagle?
Radagast.
Who we all thought was going to die and doesn't die.
I didn't. Why would he die?
Because we hoped he might.
Oh, no. But no, he's not in Lord of the Rings, and I thought maybe they would explain that. I mean, they have that freedom.
You know, Middle-earth is a big place.
I realise that, but this is, you know, the nature of prequels is that they tend to tie up too many loose ends, like the Strider thing.
Yeah.
So I kind of thought that, frankly, I thought Toriel and Radagast were going to be first up against the wall with Filly and Killy and all the other hunters.
I was expecting Toriel to go down with, expire at the same time as Filly.
Yes.
Killy. Which one is it?
She was with Killy.
Killied. In a sort of, you know, romantic kind of death embrace kind of scenario.
Yeah, I'll be honest, that's what I thought was going to happen as well. And I was a bit surprised that it didn't. But that moment with her and Thranduil, I thought was actually quite cool, and it revealed a lot about his character, at least, if not hers. So I thought that was nicely played. Mm. But I would have liked a few more individual moments, I think, in some of the battles, because I think sometimes... Peter Jackson went for the sweep and the scale and the scope of this huge thing happening, but it was a bit too massive in both senses of the word, both in terms of the software and in terms of just the scale. I wanted to see hand-to-hand combat between identifiable people in the melee as well as the sort of the single combat going off to one side.
There were moments, and I get what you're saying, it wasn't so much individual, but I really loved the sort of the dwarven choreography, the way they sort of moved as one unit, the phalanx, and then they broke apart, and then the pikes. It was, you know, absolutely military. It was fantastic.
And Dane, despite being, you know, Uncanny Valley Connolly, was cool, you know, wide shot, sort of swinging his hammer about and swearing and what have you.
And I did cheer when the elves leapt over the dwarves' backs.
Yeah, oh, that was great.
That was awesome.
That was a great moment.
Yeah.
The Dane thing's an interesting one, though. And Dane, obviously, famously, I think he had a giant red axe, which has become a hammer in the Ultimate film. So at some point, I want to know, why was he removed and why was it hammer time?
It's always hammer time.
It's always hammer time. Magnificently
no
sweary.
No disrespect.
Middle-earth is not a place one really finds expletives, but he starts the thing by what he goes, I invite you all to stod off!
That was
stod off.
Stod off. Stod off. Stod off. And then doesn't he call them buggers and bastards and whatnot?
Yeah.
There's also a nice line earlier on, which I think, I don't know how many people caught it or missed it. It's not swearing, but I really liked when Stephen Fry, as the master, said, I have to evacuate myself.
Yes.
Which...
Oh, Dan.
Doesn't mean what he thought it meant.
Oh, Dan.
But Stephen Fry knows.
I missed Stephen Fry, actually, when he got, you know, squashed. Because he's tons of fun in Smaug. And I almost wanted more of that. Because Alfred is the comic relief throughout this film.
Alleged comic relief.
I must admit, this is the one part of the film I really do think doesn't work very well. And it's one gag, repeat time and time again. He's a coward and he's greedy again and again and again.
And he's... deeply, deeply unlikable. Here's the thing. Your comic relief shouldn't be detestable.
No.
You shouldn't wish him to be crushed by a dragon the minute he appears on screen. And they, the same gag repeated three times, essentially. Three times, three different characters trust him with something. He immediately fucks it up. And yet they continue to trust him with it. Oh, so would you look after, take the night watch? there's an elf army that's just come in. Oh, well, why don't you look after my children? Oh, yeah, no, they're dead. It doesn't happen.
You had one job, Alfred.
He's just deeply unlikable and unfunny. Yeah.
He's even called Alfred Lickspittle.
Yes, although I think he has a daughter who marries a guy called Wormtongue.
No, but isn't this the thing, that he's supposed to be sort of a mirror of Wormtongue? That's the idea, that that's what that character's for. But you don't get that at all.
Wormtongue's genuinely
exactly.
Horrible.
I don't think it works. Mm. So I think that is a shame. And also feels like the tone of all the scenes that he's in feels like a different movie. It doesn't work for me at all.
I just think, I feel a bit like if you had taken out the scenes with Alfred, you could have had the scenes at the end with Bard, or you could have had Thorin's funeral, or you could have had some closure for some of the characters. The battle, for me, comes a little bit to a bit of an abrupt end. Obviously, Jackson makes the decision to focus on the battle with Thorin fighting...
Azog's name.
With Thorin fighting Azog. And that's fine, and it's cool, and it leads to some really lovely moments. But you get the sense that there's much bigger thing happening in the background. So when Azog dies, does everyone on the battlefield just kind of go, oh, that's it? That's what he's done.
I think that was interesting because in the book it does say that, you know, the tide of the battle turned when the dwarves came out the gate. And I thought the film did a really good job of making a way that that could possibly be true, that these 13 dwarves could change the tide of the battle. And they do that, first of all, by leading a charge, but secondly, by leading a raid on the enemy's leadership position. And I thought that was clever because they did set up that signalling, you know, turret was significant, and then they go and they take down the people in the signalling turret. That, you know, okay, I can see how that would turn the tide of a battle.
They
good
may
work.
Have overstated Azog's, you know, tactical genius as a general when all he really did was bellow obscenities in Orcish from on top of a hill. You know, Sun Tzu, he wasn't.
Send in the big trolls. Yeah. Send in the bigger trolls.
Unleash the beasts.
And do orcs really need to be told to kill them, take no prisoners, show no mercy? I mean, I'm not sure that that probably comes naturally.
Props, though, for the mobile siege platforms that were the trolls. I loved them, properly loved them. They had ones with ballistae on their shoulders. The head-butting battering ram troll was genius.
He was great. I laughed a lot at that.
Also, the disabled troll with the morning stars for arms and the maces for legs was quite inventive, I thought.
Mm. Yeah, a bit, you know, unfortunate for the poor fella. And the worms, who, as we just heard from Boyens, have actually some kind of, you know, textual basis and aren't just a tribute to Frank Herbert's Dune.
Yeah, so, I was expecting to see, you know, orcs on their backs, you know, riding them into battle, but they just came, waved, and then, I guess, went home.
Well, I mean, you know.
It's quite tiring, tunnelling underground for all that time, I imagine.
Where did they reverse into, though, right? If the worms were tunnelling and the orcs were following them, you saw the worms go back in, but how did the orcs then get out?
Well, you see, they tunnel quite fast, so they went back in, but at an angle.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, they made a sort of side passage that then they reversed into.
If the orcs were following them and they were burrowing through the ground for what seemed like days, I mean, the geography of Middle-earth in these films has always been weird to me. It seems to take one character 5 seconds to get from somewhere that seems miles away to another place, whereas it takes other characters days to get to cover the same ground. Anyway, that's nitpicking. It's like Empire Strikes Back when Luke gets trained how to be a Jedi in the same amount of time that they go to Cloud City. Anyway, but so they're burrowing behind the orc, behind the weirworms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So shouldn't it be covered in weirworm
poo?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the weirworms are burning up a lot of energy, I guess, digging. And therefore, there essentially are no. I got nothing. They look cool.
Yeah. Where would they rank on a great big Middle Earth Deadly 60? Where would Steve Bakshall put them on his list?
I guess they'd probably even be above the Mumakil.
Yes.
Probably.
Yes.
Although they don't have those cool tusks, but they're a lot bigger. But they're probably below the Witch King of Angmar.
Angmar. Yeah, okay. Right.
See, this another sequence I would really like to have seen. So you get the part where Legolas and Tariel go to Angmar, which is that really awesome sort of bladed, rusty fortress.
Yeah.
And
Gundabad.
Gundabad, yes. The Gundabad and the Ugly.
Yes.
And that could have been a great sequence. And don't get me wrong, I've always loved the way Jackson rallies troops like no one else. Like when you see the orcs come out, you know, and you hear the horns sounding and they stomp out, there's that real sense of foreboding. But, you know, I wanted to see a little bit of, you know, Metal Gear Solid as they infiltrate the fortress and, you know, spying on the orcs. You know, there seems like there was a whole sequence there, which I shall look forward to on the extended edition.
Unless there wasn't.
Unless there was.
In which case, I need to go back and reshoot.
Yes, immediately.
Just to satisfy your curiosity.
Peter, if you're listening, that would be really appreciated.
Indeed. I'm sure he is. Hello, Peter. So let's talk about some of the major plot developments. After two films of, frankly, fannying about, finally...
Oh, come on.
Some dwarfs get deadified
in this one.
And as we mentioned earlier on, it's all the hot dwarfs.
All of them. Yeah. 100%
that is actually
of the
true,
hot dwarfs.
Isn't it?
The message is, in this film... Messages in this film, do not be a hot dwarf.
Or you'll get killed.
Yes.
What about James Nesbitt? Is he borderline hot dwarf?
No, he's got a bad hat.
There's the hat.
It's the hat. It's an unhot hat.
It's hiding his hotness.
Yes. Okay, all right,
that's
fine.
That's
some bad hat, Bofur.
Bofur, that's his name, Bofur.
But it's the line of Durin, isn't it? Isn't that the relevant thing? Not how good-looking they are?
Well, but I mean, there are clearly cousins, because we know that, you know, Dane is explicitly... Thorin's cousin.
Yeah.
So it's not the entire bloodline. It's maybe the direct line, but yeah, there must be others. And I mean, it can't even be the direct male line, because obviously they're his sister's sons, Cillie and Cillie. So there must be, you know, they're not patrilineal necessarily dwarves. I'm just pushing my glasses up my nose as I say that. So, you know, maybe there are more in the line out there. I mean, I guess Dane is obviously the closest family member.
Well, Cillie is the first to fall. In a scene that...
Quite literally, yes.
Which, in a scene that I was curious as to whether or not that was a deliberately sanitised shot or whether this was a BBFC cut, because you don't see or indeed hear the blade going through him when he dies.
We don't want it to be grisly. We don't want it to be, you know, early Jackson.
Yes, we do.
There are enough severed heads and things being impaled and stabbed in this film to last a lifetime. If you added blood, it would be an 18-rated movie.
This is a slight, you know, ongoing niggle of mine. I really object to having real ultra-violence rendered unviolence by taking out the blood. Like, that's fine. If you don't want to be too violent, here's an idea. Don't be too violent. Instead of having people run through beheaded and chopped up without a drop of blood. I mean, sometimes there's a little seepage of blood, but there's never... anything that might indicate someone's head has been chopped off. Is everybody heating their weapons to cauterize wounds as they make them? I mean, it genuinely began to annoy me, especially in this film, because there's so much carnage and nary a drop.
Well, how do we know that orcs even have blood in the same way we have blood?
I'm not just talking about orcs. You know, there's people, you know, there's men, there's dwarves, there's elves, all killed.
Yeah.
And no blood.
Yeah, it's the weird arbitrary nature of censorship, isn't it? That blood and gore is bad, but apparently consequenceless violence is absolutely fine. One of the things I guess we just have to live with.
I know.
But
this is filmmaking tradition going all the way back, you know, in westerns where people get shot and they clutch their chest and there's not even a bullet hole in their shirt.
Or Avengers Robin Hood or, you know, swashbucklers.
Yeah, but in fairness, there was less violence in those movies. I mean, until you get up to about The Wild Bunch, there was much less violence. And it is possible to have quite a small entry wound from a gunshot, especially with the kind of small caliber bullets they were using in the Old West.
As long as you don't see them from the back.
But if you're chopping off somebody's head, I don't know. I feel like it's a different thing. Anyway, this has been a bugbear of mine ever since the Golden
Compass. We should have a podcast special just on censorship. This film, you know, has a body count in the millions, and yet if there'd been a pair of boobs in it, it would have gone two ratings further up. But
Paddington has some mild innuendo as a PG, and this is I'm assuming it's going to be a 12A.
Yeah,
I think so. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's. But yeah, it's interesting you talk about the body count. We're going to discuss the major deaths in a second. But the beginning of the film is really hardcore. You know, this is at his heart, based on a kid's book, and it begins with a dragon just nuking Lake Town and hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people, including, let's be honest here, probably Stephen Colbert, fried, crushed.
And his family.
Impaled. And, you know, it's kind of brutal in a way.
A fantastic sequence, though. Better than the whole of Reign of Fire, in fact, in 10 minutes.
Oh, you take that back.
I will not take it back.
Well, What about the bit where they put on a performance of Star Wars for
admittedly,
the kids?
That's a great sequence.
But I would agree with you. That was some proper dragon action. Mm, that's really the dragons good. You want. And even when he was wounded and he was flying up in a sort of circle above the inferno below, that was a gorgeous shot. That's my shot of the film.
I genuinely do not understand, though, why that wasn't the end of the last film. I really don't get it. That was seems such a good point that they could have ended the first film. And then they've actually got that bit where it breaks, and then it's like, and now begins this part. And I really don't get that.
But I wonder if it's because of the influence of The Empire Strikes Back. We're now, there might be a feeling that if you have a trilogy, you have to end the second movie on a point where things look bad for our heroes. And if they'd killed Smaug, even though Lake Town had been destroyed at that point, it's still a note of triumph. So maybe that's the thinking behind that.
I like the uncertainty to that note of triumph. No one's going, hooray, hooray, because Lake Town's completely destroyed. And then everyone's like, hang on a minute. Well, now this mountain's empty. What's going to happen next?
It's a pretty major effect, because maybe they hadn't given themselves an extra year to work on it. Might have been it.
That's an excuse,
honestly,
not a reason.
I wonder whether it's not that if you kill the dragon at the end of the second one, everyone kind of goes home, because the book is a book about going to kill a dragon. And once the dragon's dead, I mean, let's be honest, in the book, the Battle of the Five Armies is kind of a footnote. You know, all of the events, you've essentially resolved the primary narrative. So I think maybe he almost wanted to leave that till the last one. But Dan's absolutely right. It does feel like you've stepped into the end of the previous film. And there's even that cut, isn't it? The dragon dies, it goes to black, you see Erebor, and suddenly the title comes up, The Battle of the Five Armies. And you think, oh, right, now the film started. And I think that's a deliberate...
So that's the Bondian pre-credit sequence.
Exactly, yeah, it's your cold opening.
But what it also does is it keeps the dragon, it keeps Smaug fresh in people's minds, and it keeps the idea of the dragon and dragon sickness around, which is a very, very crucial part of the movie, and obviously Thorin succumbs to it. Mm-hmm. You know,
plus helpful flashbacks.
Plus some helpful flashbacks as well. But yeah, I thought that was a really, really, really cool sequence. In fact, I was surprised by how severely Smaug destroyed Lake Town. I mean, he torches the shit out of that place.
Yes, he does.
Nothing's left apart from that convenient clock tower where Bard uses his son as a bow.
That was a Don't nice try that moment. That was a nice moment. I did like the boy bow, as we shall call it.
We've had Bilbo and boy bow.
Boy bow, yes. I thought that's particularly well done. I also quite like that Smaug's, you know, sort of vindictiveness and arrogance knows so little bounds that he's prepared to, while slaughtering millions, stop to taunt one guy standing on a tower for having the temerity to shoot apples at him. Now, that would be an interesting film. Yeah, no, it was a good moment. And he's sort of gloating and then obviously takes a black arrow in the chest.
He monologued.
He did monologue. You see, Smaug. Have you learned nothing from movies? Never monologue.
But I'm also glad about that, because I actually thought we weren't going to get to hear Benedict Cumberbatch as Smaug one last time.
He's great.
Will you follow me one last time? I didn't think we'd get that, but it was nice to hear that moment. But from there, let's go back to the big deaths. So Killy, Philly, previously on the Empire podcast, Philly was being thrown off... off a ledge to his doom, having been stabbed already.
Yes. Yeah,
that was pretty brutal. Killy, if people who've read the book know that these dwarves said there was going to be a bit of a body count, which is good, because you know, in the Lord of the Rings saga, one member of the Fellowship dies, and that's in the first film.
Yeah,
apart from that,
well, actually, technically two die in the first film.
Just one comes back.
Yeah,
that's true. But you know, the actual body count.
There is
if you're looking at the Fellowship graveyard, there's only one tombstone.
Yeah. There is a point here in that the dwarves, I think, for all, you know, Peter Jackson, I think, said he was trying to give them distinct personalities. There is a sense that the only thing that really distinguishes them, even in the final film, is the colour and length of their beards.
And, I honestly can't tell them apart. I still can't tell them apart.
I do think this is a problem, even through the film, that they don't have distinct personalities. I think Killy and Thorin obviously do, because they have more to do than the others. Yeah. But a lot of the others, I mean...
Balin and Dwalin got a fair amount here, which was great. Graham McTavish as Dwalin and Ken Stott as Balin both came into their own. And actually, I was really glad to see that, because in the book, Balin is the one who keeps coming up over and over again as Bilbo's best friend among the dwarves.
Oh, really?
It's not really Thorin. He's a bit remote. He's a bit untouchable, which I think, to be honest, he has been in the last two films as well. But it's Balin who kind of keeps him sane.
Let's not forget the guy with the ear horn.
Yes.
Who, in every scene, whatever's happening, whether or not someone's speaking... puts the ear horn up to his ear.
Bless him.
Is that Oin?
Maybe it's the horn of Gondor.
Yes.
Balin actually is great, because Graham McTavish genuinely looks like he could break your shit in half.
It's Dwalin.
Dwalin, sorry, they're all the same to me. I'm just a dwarf racist. But there's a sequence at the end when they go to Ravenhill, and you think, well, Graham McTavish is there, they're fine because he will sort yeah. shit out. And obviously Peter Shatter thought, you know what, that's a good point. Goblin mercenaries. And so suddenly, out of nowhere, a company of goblin mercenaries come over the hill specifically to distract Graham McTavish.
And that is a great line, by the way. Goblin mercenaries, no more than 100, we'll handle them. Brilliant.
Although, hang on a minute. Yes. No. That's earlier on. That's earlier on in the fight. The goblin mercenaries come and Thorin and Dwalin take them on. Uh-huh. Bilbo comes up, warns them about the additional attack, right? Mm-hmm. That's when Thorin realizes that Filly and Killy need to come out of the place he sent them into to die. Then Thorin goes off to, and then it's Filly and Killy, and then Dwalin and Bilbo are dealing with not goblin mercenaries, the big, cool-looking, white-eyed orcs that come at them. Bilbo gets knocked on the head. Then Dwalin disappears. You know, now Dwalin could have turned the tide of the battle, Thorin versus Azog. He could have helped save Filly and Killy, but he just disappears.
Part-timer.
Yeah.
Yeah, presumably he's off fighting orcs somewhere. Let's just assume.
I actually thought he died.
Oh, no. Yeah,
I thought he had
but
died.
He is specifically yeah. there on,
but he's
on
there,
the
end.
Yeah.
I was a little bit disappointed. I was actually quite glad that Bilbo got knocked out for a bit, just because you couldn't have him knocked out for the whole battle, but it was a nice little nod to the book. Mm. But I was a little bit disappointed that he didn't get to shout the eagles are coming as they arrive. because, I don't know, it felt like that was a cool thing. I remember that in the book and being really excited about it. And
I wonder if people know, if they've not read The Hobbit recently, that when Bilbo gets knocked out, that's basically the end of the battle, because he wakes up and the eagles have resolved it all.
Yeah.
So the conclusion of the battle essentially happens off screen or off page.
Gandalf basically tells him what happened and then he goes to see Thorin's deathbed. And
it's Twilight
it's all
over again.
Sad. Yeah.
Or all beginning before, or in 1937.
Let's talk about Killy's death before we move on to Thorin, Oakenshield. It's obviously meant to have an emotional impact.
Mm. Didn't. You can tell because it hangs on his face for 20 seconds while he dies.
It does. It didn't for me, I'll be honest, but I've always been cold to the Toriel Killy relationship. Mainly because I'm just trying to figure out how it will work. I mean,
you're against interspecies sex.
No, I'm not. No. I'm absolutely not. In fact, I've got a number of great videos I can show you, but there's.
The hands.
Yes.
Again,
the fake hands.
Part. The fake hand. It's her huge hands, his little hands.
He is very tall for a dwarf, she notes. So he's not meant to be that much shorter than her. Mm. But he has big fake hands. That's the thing I was thinking of. He's got giant hands and she has quite normal-sized ones. But I thought it was quite sweet. I thought it was quite touching in the end.
I think she sold it very well. The whole where she's sort of facing off against Thranduil over it. I think that's a nice touch.
I think he had less to do in that scene. I think he made his mark in the earlier scene by the lake when they're leaving Lighttown. I thought he was really, really sweet there. And totally handsome. So
for a dwarf.
He's a hot dwarf.
He's a hot dwarf.
The only one without prosthetics,
now,
I might add.
Dan, you've seen the extended editions more recently than me.
Yes.
They do explain somewhere why he had to shave his beard off, didn't they?
Not in the Desolation of Smaug extended edition.
No, in the first one.
In the first one. No, I haven't seen that recently. Why?
There's an explanation. Really? Apparently he lost a bet or something. All dwarves should have beards, and the fact that he doesn't is due to losing a bet or something of that nature. I can't
with
remember.
With those cheekbones?
I don't think so.
But yeah, okay. You know, so you guys were a little bit more taken by the Tariel Killy relationship than I was. Fair enough. Cool. I mean, you know, he was... A good dwarf, and may he rest in peace.
Mm. I mean, it's all right for Aragorn to fancy an elf in the first ones, humans and elves. Why shouldn't dwarves and elves be allowed to get it on?
Yeah,
and,
sizist.
Hmm? I'm not a sizist! It's absolutely fine, it's okay, sure, it'll be fine. Okay, let's talk about Thorin Oakenshield, because even though the film is called The Hobbit, this movie, more than the others, belongs to Richard Armitage.
As opposed to the agents of Oakenshield.
I'm giving you a hard stare, a la Paddington. I thought, let's talk about the character, first of all, Thorin, who, as we kind of mentioned to Richard Armitage in the interview you're about to hear, really gets to run the gamut here. He goes insane, he loses his mind completely, he has a lovely redemptive moment, he gets a big fight with a CG orc, and then he gets a wonderful heroic death. So this must have been whenever he was reading the script going, oh yeah, yeah, this is it. This is it. This is the stuff I'm looking forward to playing. What do we make of Thorin in this movie?
I think he's great. I loved the descent into madness. I thought that sort of worked very well. It kind of kept, because again, you have to make sense of the fact that he's frankly being utterly unreasonable. And my favourite moment of that is the discussion he has with Bard shot through the hole in the barricade. I thought that's wonderfully framed. Just a really, really lovely shot. And then of course the moment where the man just seizes him and he starts hallucinating dragons and lights, and you get that sort of weird, psychedelic, almost 60s-esque sort of light patterns flashing on his face. The use of slow-mo as he's talking to show, you know, universal sign of madness, speaking in slow motion.
It reminded me of like Garth Marenghi joke where they, you know, we were running 8 minutes short. Each episode was running 8 minutes short, so we had to use slow mo to bump up the running time. Where possible, we try to avoid using it over dialogue. but that moment where he talks to Bilbo and he's basically saying, "Oh, you know, I suspect that I've been betrayed by my kin," and he starts speaking, and there's a little bit of slow mo in the voice as well. But Armitage's voice drops down. Like several octaves lower than it normally does. It feels almost like, you know, he talks in the interview about it's analogous, the dragon sickness, to heroin addiction, or, you know, some other addiction to some other drug, caffeine perhaps. But in that moment, for me, it felt more like demonic possession than anything else. You know, you almost expect his face to turn like Bilbo's does in the first movie, or even Galadriel's does in Fellowship, and indeed here as well. But yeah, I think it's a really, really well modulated performance. And the moment where he descends into the sort of psychotropic madness and, you know, comes through it didn't entirely work for me, but it really buys, I guess, the moment where he returns as a triumphant warrior and goes, "Will you follow me one last time?"
He comes out of it very quickly. It's not a gradual thing. He just seems to snap out of it after the hallucination.
He doesn't go cold turkey, for example, you know, spending 6 weeks in a room crying. He doesn't have time to.
But I like that you explicitly hear what kind of brings him back to himself is the voices of his friend and family, and I think that's good. But to be honest, I mean, I love Richard Armitage, by the way. If you haven't seen The Crucible, it's going to be on cinema screens soon, so you should try and check that out from his stage performance this summer. But to me, Man of the Match was Martin Freeman. I thought he was absolutely astonishing in this. Just little tiny moments. And I don't think anyone really does little tiny moments as well as Martin Freeman does.
That's great.
Even just sitting wordless next to Gandalf after the battle.
That's a great. The smoke machine scene.
Absolutely incredible scene. You know, his reactions during Thorin's death scene, heartbreaking, utterly heartbreaking. I thought he was wonderful.
I love the scene where he turned up at Thranduil's tent.
Yes.
And there's Bard and Thranduil there, and he actually brings out the Arkenstone. Yeah. And,
well,
you know.
in a movie that is short on levity, it has that has the funniest moment where Thranduil basically goes, "You're the burglar who stole my keys," and he goes, "Yes." Because Martin Freeman has this, he must have this incredible, almost like a Pantone chart of comedic reactions and deadpan, you know. It's just fantastic. I think I've said this before in the podcast, I think his performance in all three films is one of the best, if not the best performance in the entire saga. I think he's fantastic. I think he brings a humanity to Bilbo that is really endearing.
He turns befuddlement into a kind of zen-like art form. It's astonishing.
He really does. But for me, still, I think Bilbo gets slightly sidelined in the movie because of the nature of the battle, and obviously he gets knocked unconscious for a bit. That doesn't help either. But for me, the movie does belong to Armitage and Thorin Oakenshield. This is more his story, I think, than Bilbo's at this point. And I think Armitage really sells it well. I think it's a very interesting take on the character. And Helen, you were talking about your favourite shot. My favourite shot is when Thorin watches what looks to be the corpse of Azog floating underneath the ice. And that's a lovely moment for me. We're all expecting him to open his eyes at that moment, but you know, but it's still a pretty lovely shot, and I love their fight as well, especially when you hear the interview with Richard Armitage, and you'll hear how they did that fight.
Yeah,
for it to come out as well as it did is pretty amazing.
The Ravenhill sequence as a whole, I think, is the high point of the battle. It's very nice. You get the sort of the crowd pleasing stuff where you've got Legolas doing his elven acrobatics when he runs up that sort of falling staircase of dropping stone, which is fantastic. You know, all the stuff with Bolg where he's fighting with him. Yeah. The only thing that maybe seems a little odd is when Thorin's fighting with Azog on the lake. Azog has a sword arm. In many ways, very close to Richard Armitage's head, and yet he insists on swinging around a block of concrete on a chain. Not a master tactician. That's
right. Didn't he see Batman Begins?
Yeah.
It reminded me, of course, of that sequence in the Jack Reacher novel, The Affair, when Reacher finds a man with a hammer.
And I think, modelled on that scene.
I would imagine so. I imagine most movies are modelled on Jack Reacher.
Also, just in case anyone doesn't know, that Azog is in fact voiced and performed by Manu Bennett, who we all see a lot more of in really every sense in Spartacus. So if you want to see his cock, that's the place to go.
I would say that with the brief mention of Bolg earlier, there is a kind of an Easter egg in this film, which is the orc jailer in Dol Guldur, the one that taunts Gandalf.
Okay.
Do you remember this? He talks, the one that talks Gandalf and pulls the cage down and rolls
vanishes.
It around. And gets swiftly dispatched. Very early on, I think it was after, it was around the time of the first Hobbit film, they released a picture of Bolg, what Bolg was going to look like in the next film. And the picture was of somebody wearing a prosthetic suit. And it looked very different from the Bolg that eventually appeared in Desolation of Smaug. And there were quite a lot of people who had spotted this and complained because they'd really liked, including Nick, in fact, Empire's Nick DeSemelin, had complained that they preferred the original character design. Well, that Jailer Orc is the original Bolg.
That's unbelievable, Bolg.
Hmm? Oh. There you go.
And if we want to see Bolg's cock in real life, where will we go?
Oh, goodness.
I don't know, New Zealand?
Where it's currently on display.
At the workshop.
At the Te Papa Museum, yeah. Does anyone have anything more to add on the Dol Guldur situation? As I said, this is my biggest missed opportunity. I think, you know, you have a massive battle royale between, I don't know, the Nazgul and Elrond and Galadriel and Saruman. It's the greatest moment in the history of cinema, and it's over in seconds.
Well, it's not even just Saruman. It's not just Saruman. It's Gandalf. It's the first time we've ever seen apart from the council in the first film of The Hobbit, it's the first time we've seen the three wielders of the elf rings together. Like, you know, in a fighting situation. I was geeking out.
Against the Witch King of Angmar.
Against the Witch King of Angmar. I mean, yeah, I was kind of geeking out just at the situation.
Yeah.
That's Gandalf, Elrond and Galadriel.
Does Gandalf have an elf ring?
He does, yes.
Oh, I thought Galadriel's husband had the other elf ring.
No, he's just a consort. He doesn't matter.
Ah. Galadriel does have some serious game, though. I think
she's got major game.
I get this, and I was speaking to Ian about this in the office, that this isn't Sauron's film. You know, Sauron is about Lord of the Rings. This isn't about Sauron. I think the difficulty is for us, having seen Lord of the Rings, everything's about Sauron. And once you've seen Sauron, it's kind of hard to get that upset about marauding orcs because it's Dark Lord, the servant of Morgoth. You know, he's there. And that could have been, you know... But then the whole point is it could have been a lot, but it then, I suppose, would have overshadowed the rest of the film. So I guess you need to move on from that to give the other stuff perspective.
Yeah.
But you're right, it is over very, very quickly. And in fact, it's never, to my mind anyway, entirely established what's happening. It's like, where the Nazgul come from? And yeah, you're talking about the three ring bearers, of course, so the elf ring bearers. Gandalf's a little bit out of it at that point.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a shame. He really isn't involved in that battle. But I also love the aftermath as well, where they're going, oh, so we've kind of banished Sauron. It's going to take a while. And, you know, Saruman basically goes, oh, you leave him to me. Don't worry. I've got this, guys. Nothing bad will happen. It's all good. It's, you know, it's
nothing to see here. Carry on.
Yeah.
Why doesn't anyone ever listen to Elrond?
I know.
This is it. It's just like, you're like, Elrond's like, yeah, okay, destroy the ring now. Destroy the ring. No, we're going to keep it. And Elrond's like, oh, listen to me. This time it's like, Elrond's like, okay, now we've got the perfect opportunity to solve this. Saruman's like, no, leave it to me. It's like Elrond's like, you know.
He's like 5,000 years old.
Yeah, it's not so much Elrond the half-elven as Elrond the half-listened to.
Christopher Lee is a hell of a mover for a guy in his 90s.
Yeah.
I presume he did all his own stunts.
I'm sure he did all his own stunts.
He learned all those moves on The Man with the Golden Gun.
Yeah.
Did I tell you I knew J.R.R. Tolkien? Yes, you did. Okay. Okay. Gandalf, very, very quickly. A little bit sidelined in the movie. I don't know if you get enough Gandalf for your buck in this one.
I feel like he's always best as an enabler, if you will, of other people's adventures. He shouldn't be necessarily always leading the way himself. And to that extent, he does quite well here. I liked seeing him sort of not manipulate Bard and the Elf King and Thorin, but at least try and bring about peace, at least try and do some diplomacy there. That was kind of cool.
Well, I actually like the way that, you know, quite often Gandalf turns up and everyone like listens reverently. I actually really like the fact that Thranduil was just like, I'm not listening to you. You just mess around, you know, you complain and you moan and you shout warnings and I'm still doing my own thing. I really like that little kind of exchange.
Thranduil, the faithless woodland sprite, which I thought was perhaps the best put down of the film.
And the end. You said earlier on with Gandalf, I thought it was interesting that Gandalf basically says, oh, I knew all along you had a magic ring. I knew it. I just didn't want to say.
Yeah.
Did that ring false with anyone?
And I asked Boyens when exactly he knows, and she kind of sidestepped the question a little bit, I thought. I mean, listen back to that interview, yeah. But she didn't quite answer it.
I wonder whether it's important to Gandalf at that point, because the magic rings seem to be, you know, a dime a dozen in Middle-earth these days.
Yeah, so maybe that's it.
So maybe that is what. But here's a question for you. Why doesn't the ring make Sauron invisible?
Because Sauron because it's part of him, maybe? It's greater than he is?
You're just making up
words. I'm making up words. Yeah.
I think Gandalf knew about the ring in An Unexpected Journey.
Okay.
I think he knew about the ring when Bilbo first appeared with it.
Yeah,
there's a moment between them. Mm-hmm. And then in the second film, there's another moment where he goes, what did you find?
Yes,
and
I think he's
waiting, he's just waiting for Bilbo to tell him, and Bilbo still doesn't. And you can see this look. So I think there's a thread all the way through that makes that moment work.
I agree, James, earlier on that Bilbo lies to Gandalf for the first time in the movie. I don't think he does. He's blind to him all the way through the three films.
But I think it's the sense of corruption. That's for me, it's the point where you see the ring's corruption starting to take hold of him. You feel it.
Yeah, but it doesn't corrupt him. He basically just...
Because the ring corrupts hobbits in the end, it just takes longer.
Yeah, but it takes them a long, long time indeed. Do you think we'll find out more about the ring? Do you think they'll make any more movies about it? I'm really intrigued to see where this one goes.
Silmarillion, the movie.
We can hope, Chris.
Yeah?
We can hope.
I just want to know where it came from, who it belongs to, and how they're going to destroy it, if indeed they ever will.
Why would they destroy it? I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe we'll find out more one these days. But this is... Until the next one, anyway, the last of the Lord of the Rings movies. A fitting end to the all six films, do you think?
A fitting middle.
Yeah. I mean, I'm still sort of torn on... We were discussing on the podcast last week what order to watch films in, where the chronological order of release is not the same as the chronological narrative order. And I'd still probably be tempted to watch The Lord of the Rings before The Hobbits, for someone who had never seen them before. But at the same time, this was a heck of a lot of fun, and you could absolutely watch them right through and see things develop and grow once you've already seen them once. I really enjoyed this. Yeah. It's not quite up there with the greatest of the Lord of the Rings. My favourite's possibly Fellowship, but it's a heck of a film.
Yeah, they're maybe not the artistic triumphs of the first three Rings movies, as evidenced by the fact it isn't in the Oscar conversation.
And yet, I think props need to be given to Peter Jackson for the fact that in Lord of the Rings he adapted arguably the greatest fantasy books of all time into the greatest fantasy films of all time. With this, he took a much lesser piece of literature and still turned it into something great. It's not as great, but really, if you look at the source, it never could have been. So I think, still lots of respect to Peter for that.
I'm just looking forward to the special editions of The Lord of the Rings that put Tariel in them. when all the elves are leaving, she'll just CG her into it, so she's one of the elves, and she'll just walk past and go,
hello.
Do you think he's going to go full Lucas? Like, every 5 years, he's going to go in and change something else, tweak a little bit. The elves will be holding walkie-talkies when they come into Rivendell.
I'm hoping he'll be too busy making Temeraira.
Indeed. And, now, of course, shared universes are all the rage. Why not have an Alfred Lickspittle spin-off? I want to see that. I'm sure we all want to see that. No? Okay, just me? All right. That is it for our The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies spoiler special. Probably could talk about this one for a long, long time, but sadly time is against us. Thank you, of course, to Helen.
Thank you.
To Dan.
Maria.
And to James.
I leave you with one thought.
Don't. And of course, it's goodbye from me. Before we do go, though, here's the final interview of the spoiler special. Will you listen to Richard Armitage one last time? Helen and I went along to talk to him in London earlier this week. Enjoy. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by Richard Armitage. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hey, how are you? I'm very good, thank you.
This is Thorin's Journey. This is the part, I imagine, when you got the script, this is the bit you were looking forward most to doing. You get to go mad, you get to have a big fight at the end, you get to have a moment of redemption.
It was interesting because the first draft of the script was a sketch of what it ultimately evolved into. And the end of the book is relatively brief compared to the detail with which Pete Fran and Phil imagined in their screenplay. But it was a real privilege to take on the dragon sickness and really investigate something very abstract and daring.
How do you do that? You can't research dragon sickness. There are no dragons around. I've just checked.
I kind of looked at equivalent types of addiction. So drug addiction, a bit of schizophrenia, mental illnesses, and how they affected your body, and what kind of irrational mind it would create. And then I sort of put it into the idea of a fantasy movie, so that it wasn't like a medical condition, but we could kind of wall him up in the mountain and make him really go crazy. And the ultimate manifestation of that is Pete's very kind of avant-garde, abstract moment where Thorin is pulled out of the gold that's enveloping him.
Yeah, I love that moment. How did you film that? Was it green screen, or did you? Because there are moments when the lights are shining in your eyes. I imagine I almost picture Peter shining lights, literally shining lights into your eyes as that scene was being filmed.
You know, in the screenplay, it was a single stage direction where Thorin sees his own reflection, and I think he sees the dragon coming back at him, which was a very literal imagining of what that scene might be. And I really like the fact that Peter kept it more open and ambiguous, and that it's really about Thorin's memory of the entire quest and who has influenced him along the way, and the words that bring him back. And it's much more sparse than I imagined. I think at one point there was going to be piles of gold everywhere, but we've already seen that. So yeah, Pete built like a completely green platform with a ramp, and he said, "Is there anything else you need?" I was like, "Yeah, can we put some weird music on?" And I'd like two stunt guys to tie some ropes to my feet so that they could sort of drag me down and pull me back.
Oh, really?
Down this ramp, as if he was being really sucked into the gold. So yeah, it was a fun morning.
Wow, that's proper acting. That is, you know, you've got very little there to work with, and just sort of, you know, using your body essentially to get the emotions.
Yeah, I mean, I just thought, well, let's have a little experiment and see what we come up with.
It's a cool scene, and I love that you do have those callbacks to the whole quest, and you see him being essentially pulled back by friendship. And I think that's a very Tolkien thing throughout. There's always that something corrupting people, and it's other people who kind of pull them back from themselves.
Yeah, I think that's really at the heart of the story, and it's something I love about the way Pete works, is that in a single moment he can just remind you of why we've come on this tale with him so far. And it's through the words of the protagonists of Bilbo and Gandalf, those lines that Tolkien gives us. And I think really Tolkien puts himself in the heart of the Hobbit, and he himself at the time that the book was being written was afraid of a looming war in Europe, and he's reminding us to sort of cherish home.
Definitely. I think he was a bit of a hobbit himself, though. I mean,
I think he is.
Loved,
I think
loved waistcoats,
he's absolutely a hobbit. Although I think Peter Jackson's a hobbit too.
Are you expecting people to say, "Will you follow me one last time?"
I hope so. I think it's a really great kind of catchphrase, don't you?
Yeah,
I've just one last time. One last time. Until the next. One last podcast.
One last time, but then another last.
But
time.
Then but just one more last time. Yeah. It's like the eternal farewell tour, isn't it?
I promise this is definitely.
This
the
is
last
definitely
time.
The last one. This is it. Yeah, there you go.
This is it. I mean, you filmed this about a year and a half ago now, or something like that?
People keep saying it was 3 years ago. Some people have said it's 4 years ago. I've kind of I've lost track of time. It feels like yesterday. That's what's so interesting about it. And again, it's testament to Peter Jackson. It feels so vivid when you see it on screen. Yeah. When I see it on screen, everything comes flooding back. It's such a sensory experience as you're working, and I remember every detail about it.
Do you remember what the last thing you shot was?
I do. It's the moment when Thorin has to choose whether he lets Azog's sword run through his chest or whether he tries to hold him off until his last breath. And he makes that decision, and that was my last shot. The close-up of the look in his eyes of deciding to die in order to save his people. And it was an emotional shot, and you know, lots of tears were shed afterwards.
Wow, what a great place to finish, though.
It was, and
what a great moment.
I think it wasn't by accident. I think Pete decided, I want that last shot to be his last shot. Even though what happened afterwards is sort of the end, but really the moment that Thorin's lights go out are in that moment.
Yeah.
He chooses death.
You were feeling almost in the same mindset as him. This is it, I'm going out.
Yeah, and I sort of didn't really know. I didn't know it was my last shot until I looked over and everyone had gathered, and Pete went, that was it. That was the end.
Oh my God.
It's quite hard when you hear those words from working on something for so long, when Pete said, okay, you're wrapped, you're done.
Oh my God.
You don't believe him. You're like, come on, you're going to bring us back, aren't you?
There must be one more.
Yeah.
Just one more. Did you get a nice wrap gift? I know that they tend to give wrap gifts whenever you're a part.
You know, the wrap gifts came at the end of the first block, before I think they decided that they were making three films. But I was gifted a sword and the oaken shield, the map and the key, which I treasure.
And just going back to the fight with Azog. How did you do it? What was there? Was Manu there, or was...
It wasn't Manu. It was a really, really tall basketball-y playing stunt guy who was, I think, about 7 foot tall with a little extra foot on his head of like a spike, so that with an eye line. But he was amazing. He really, really fought every beat of that fight and worked so hard. And, you know, the thing is, when an actor's fighting a stunt guy, all the attention goes to how, you know, how the actor is. And this, he just worked so hard and was relentless. And had it not been for him getting back up on his feet and starting again, it, you know, it inspires me to be like, come on, you've got to give it another go. And Pete just kept asking for more and more and more. And I was spent by the end. But what I loved about it is that they built the lake. They built like a, they poured a floor and they wet it down so that it was really truly slippy. We shot on a hydraulic gimbal for when the ice breaks up, and it tilted to 45 degrees and there were crash mats around. So I would constantly come off it, but it was great. It felt very, very dangerous. Yeah. And it's a great metaphor, because I think at that moment in the story, Thorin is really on thin ice and it's breaking up beneath his feet. And I think it's just a great image.
And then you have a death scene to film with Martin Freeman.
Yeah.
Now, I imagine, I know he's the soul of professionalism. I also imagine that that's quite a weird thing to shoot, and that you might have broken up a little bit at times.
How do you mean broken up?
As in just breaking into laughter kind of thing?
Never.
No.
Not for a single second. It was really weird, because maybe it was something about setting the tone, that with that kind of scene, you just can't do that. It's like I stayed on the ground all day and people left me alone. No one kind of came in and did any checks. Martin, it's weird, because you know there will be one or two takes where it really kind of grabs your soul. And you know, Martin had a number of takes, but I'd shot all of my stuff first, so he'd really taken me to that point. So I am then responsible for making sure that he gets to that moment. And you know, we just treat it with respect, because it's one of the great characters dying. And strangely, after we'd played the scene and I stood up, I put a little cross on the ground, because I just didn't want anyone walking over where he'd lain. And people, by the end of the day, people had come and laid flowers in this place. I mean, it sounds, you know, schmaltzy now, but it people had that kind of respect. So
that's lovely.
Weird. We created a little grave for Thorin.
In the book, he's buried with the Arkenstone. Did you film that sequence?
We did, yeah. I think it will be probably something for the extended cut. Again, a really, really beautiful, probably a bit more of a noble, majestic scene. Mm. But I didn't really miss it from the cut of the film. I think playing the same beat twice, in a way, it's dying twice.
Yeah.
But I think it will make for a great piece of extra on the extended edition.
Fantastic. And the very last thing is, how would you like people to remember Thorin? Because he's essentially the bad guy in this movie for the first half.
I'd like to remember. I will remember him, and I would like audiences to remember him as he emerges from the mountain in that battle charge. Because I'd had that image of him in my head from the very beginning, the moment where he leaps from the mountain and cries to me, men and elves, to me, oh my, what does he say? Oh my people. Yeah, it was something that I'd, you know, imagined in my head. And it's the moment in the movie that grabs me by the heart.
One last time, Richard Armitage. Until the next time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's it. We're done. We're all off to Google Boggs Cock. See you next time. The podcasts are back on Friday. The Nick spoiler special of next year will probably be Fast and Furious 7. That's something to look forward to, isn't it? Until then, thanks. Bye.